The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning. It's Richard Gordon here, along with intern Rachel Silva. And today we're up in the Mechanical Hall Gallery talking with Julie McGee, an associate professor of Black American Studies and Art History, and Curtis Small, coordinator, public services from the Library Special Collections, about this really colorful exhibition you have up here for the spring semester. Tell us about it.
I always think it's useful, and in fact, when I bring classes over here, I ask them to think about what the heck the title means, and then if they want, they're able to read a little bit of the description underneath. So the title of the exhibition is, So What Have We Learned? Black Visual Cultures at UD. And that is really where I actually kind of begin my conversation about the exhibition. And after that, there's a notation, if you read the wall text, it says, So what we have learned highlights synergies among the collections within the University of Delaware Libraries, Special Collections, and Museums. Focused on African American art and Black visual culture, the selection process for the exhibition began with the formative question, What materials express Black visual culture? And that's what I actually want people to do when they come into the exhibition.
And looking at the title, it made me think, well, what is visual culture and what is Black visual culture? I imagine that people would have that question if they haven't encountered the phrase before when they come to the exhibit. And I don't think I'm not going to try to sum that up in one phrase, but I would say that I'm happy about this collaboration that has happened between Special Collections and the University Museums, because it broadens, at least somewhat, our thinking about what visual culture is. Visual culture can be manifest in books as well as in works of art, and even in print on a page. The way the type and print appears on a page can be an expression of visual culture. So I think this exhibit is letting us think about what visual culture is and Black visual culture in a lot of really interesting ways.
You know, and I'm thinking, though, that there is not one thing here that's part of this Black visual culture that you have advertised. I mean, there are so much variety in here.
Right. So I'm going to take us in this room to use an example that I like to use that plays off this idea of Black visual culture and collections, because what this exhibition does do is focus on the fact that the university museums and the libraries are now one unit. The Mechanical Hall Gallery, this space is dedicated to African American and African diasporic programming, arts and culture. So there's a certain expectation. I don't know what is filled in that expectation, but it is dedicated to artistic productivity, artistic creativity, and programming around the African and African American production, right? So the Black diaspora. I use this as an example. This is a print by Jacob Lawrence of the Schomburg Library in New York. The Schomburg Library belongs to the New York Public Library library system. It's on 135th Street in Harlem in New York, but it is a collection dedicated to what, Curtis?
African American print culture, books, primary sources, research materials. It is, I would say, probably the most important collection in the world of African American and African diaspora research materials.
So if you go there, you know that's what you're going to find. Right? And in fact, Jacob Lawrence, as a young artist, would frequently go to the Schomburg Library in New York because he wanted to find out research on Toussaint Louverture, Harriet Tubman, John Brown, information that he was not being taught in his own education as a boy, but would find it in the materials collected in the Schomburg Library, at that point in time called the 135th Street branch of the New York Public Library.
we could say a whole lot about the Schomburg and the importance of the Schomburg for special collections librarianship and especially African-American librarianship and rare books, if you want to use that term. The Schomburg is of seminal importance. And I'm so excited that the Mechanical Hall Gallery is here because Julie and other curators have done a brilliant job of featuring the work, the artistic expression of African-American individuals, artists, creators of print culture and visual cultural materials. And when you start getting into libraries and the connection with visual culture, there's so many things come together and converge so much that, you know, having learned about the Schomburg a long time ago when I was a student and coming here now and finding another collection with it and a connection with art, which I've always loved, is really powerful.
Let's talk a little bit about the actual work itself. Is this a print of a painting or is it an actual print?
This is a color lithograph.
Okay.
Jacob Lawrence made several images of the Schomburg Library because it was a space that he spent so much time in. One of the things I want to point out, when people come to this space in the same way they would go to the Schomburg Library in New York, imagine maybe you take the subway there, right? You take the subway, you get up, you get off, you walk from 125th Street up to the Schomburg Library. You don't have to have anything in your head per se about what you're going to find there because you know you're going to go there and you're going to find things related to Africa and the African diaspora.
This image that we've stopped in front of is actually by a UD alum.
And what, can you read the title?
So What Have We Learned? Why does that sound familiar?
This is by Darius Stewart, who received his Master's in Fine Arts from the University of Delaware.
And this is a really interesting piece. So What Have We Learned? You see a child. It's done in ink on UPO. I don't know what UPO is, a type of paper, I assume. You see a child. It almost looks like watercolor. The child, however, a young boy, it looks like, is holding something in front of him from mid-level to his face, and it goes down and it covers his lower body. He's holding what looks like a blank piece of paper or a blank something that's obscuring most of his body with whiteness. He's holding something white that's hiding most of his body, but you see his eyes, you see the top part of his face, you see his legs, and when Julie gave a gallery talk and visit, this was a piece that people had a lot of interesting questions and reactions to. So What Have We Learned? Some people were suggesting that by having this blankness, this whiteness in front of the child, it could serve as a mirror for people to talk about what has the work of representing the Black body, what has it hidden, and maybe what has it revealed. And people had other interesting interpretations too.
On one level, it is literally fill in the blank in the same way that our investigations into special collections were filling in the blank. What have we learned from this beginning inquiry into the synergies between the university museums and special collections? What did we fill in there? Part of it is what you see here. Another is, how is this space that is blank, and as Curtis noted, white, how is it pre-filled by assumptions we take and carry in our head? This gets back to that question, if you walk into a space and it's dedicated for something specific, there's some contour. If you walk into a space and it's not dedicated to anything specific, Morris Library beyond collections, what am I gonna find there? And how one of the things that happens to kind of prove that point is almost all of us, when we stand in front of this, and part of it is the way Darius Stewart has really manipulated the shadow such that with the hands appear to be holding, as Curtis said, a poster or a sheet of paper that's blank because we have a shadow cast from these little hands.
It's suggested.
But there is no delineation of any sheet of paper or any poster. Nothing whatsoever. We pre-fill that. Mm-hmm. We put in that something that makes sense to us. And that's also one of the points of the exhibition, is to remind us that we are always filling in contours of things we don't really see.
Why don't we move to another piece here. And Curtis, that one that you said is the first one that you walk up to every time. Henry Asawa Tanner, His Boyhood Dreams Come True.
So this piece, Henry Asawa Tanner, His Boyhood Dreams Come True, is a print. It's a serigraph print. And Julie can give us a definition of a serigraph print, maybe, if she cares to. But when I walked in to this exhibit the first time, I walked straight to this print at first, because when I looked at it, I said, it jumped out at me. I said, that looks like Faith Ringgold's work. It is work by Faith Ringgold, the artist and quilt maker, painter, African-American woman, very, very well known. And what is so powerful about this piece is that what it represents is the African-American painter, Henry Asawa Tanner, who was born in the 19th century and who was mm-hmm. the first African-American painter to achieve international prominence. This depicts the moment when Henry Tanner was in Fairmount Park. He sees a landscape painting on the ground in the park, green park setting, and he sees a painter at the easel, probably working on another landscape painting. And according to the label, this stuck with him, and this is what sparked his interest in becoming a painter. He went on to study in Paris. His work is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and many other places. Now, I grew up across the street from, well, in my early childhood, we lived right across from Fairmount Park. Mm-hmm. And to come here and to learn that this is where a well-known, famous painter, that he got the love of painting right across the street from me, I think it fits really well into the question, what have we learned and what can you learn when looking at a piece of art?
Your listeners can't see. Curtis is describing Tanner. Tanner is a young boy. He's in the park. He's situated on the right-hand side of this print. And he's standing with his father. And as the young boy and his father stop and look at the painter who's also working on an easel, they're looking at a painter who is also African American. It's not a white painter. So the significance also of this work is to suggest the long arc of history of African American artists in not only in Philadelphia, but in American history. In the same way that in the other room we have a book by Phyllis Wheatley, who was brought to the U.S. enslaved in the 1700s, went on to publish a book of poetry. And there's a portrait of her that was also done by an enslaved man brought to the U.S., Scipio Moorhead, that dates to the 1700s as well. So it is all about building that arc of history. So Henry Asawa Tanner was inspired by, in this image of Faith Ringgold, another African-American painter who was painting a landscape. And significantly, if it's an African-American painter who we imagine is painting landscapes, perhaps he's even painting landscapes at Fairmount Park, that too is Black visual culture.
We're up in the University Museum Galleries talking with Julie McGee, an associate professor of Black American Studies and Art History, who has curated the exhibition that we're touring. And also with us today is Curtis Small, Coordinator, Public Services of Library Special Collections. Rich Campbell from WVUD, and also a library employee, has joined us. Rich, is there an image you'd like Curtis and Julie to talk about with us?
Well, as a proud English major graduate of UD, I'd like to see the Phyllis Wheatley item we just mentioned.
This is the Phyllis Wheatley book, a book of poems over here. It was published in 1773. And Curtis, I know from Rebecca that this is one of the most sought after items in special collections by high school classes.
That very well may be true. Wouldn't surprise me. It's the kind of thing I definitely like to bring out to show students, because with the publication of this book, Poems on Various Subjects, Phyllis Wheatley launched the tradition of African-American women writing, publishing, and writing poetry. So when you talk about the arc of history, African-American poets still consciously refer to Phyllis Wheatley as an inspiration.
Phyllis Wheatley and the artist to whom this is attributed, the portrait of Phyllis Wheatley is attributed, Scipio Moorhead, both were able to achieve fluency in writing and in draftsmanship, or we would say artistic abilities, because they happened to have owners who were willing to educate them as well.
However, Phyllis Wheatley's example is a cautionary tale as well, and it points to a difficult tradition that African-American women writers have had a very hard time over the centuries getting published and establishing themselves. And Phyllis Wheatley herself, once her vogue was over, once people, fashionable people, wealthy people were no longer interested in her as what proof of what an African-American could do, she went on in freedom to die of poverty. In Boston, she lived a very short life. However, her work lives on long after her. However, as recently as the 20th century, even to this day, people have a difficult time. A writer like Zora Neale Hurston was the only African-American woman in the early mid-20th century making her living as a professional writer, and she herself had a really difficult end. So.
And in fact, you know, to your point, although we use that word, the civil rights movement, because we kind of, you know, put a date around it and suggest it as a movement, African-American people and African people from the diaspora before and after Phyllis Wheatley have been fighting for civil rights. It just wasn't named and codified into the kind of expressive movement that you see in relationship to your understanding of Jacob Lawrence's image.
And I also say, I was not a part of the curatorial decisions in this exhibit, Special Collections. We had wonderful meetings with Julie and with Harrison, the other curator, Harrison Graves. I noticed that one of the curators decided to put Phyllis Wheatley's book next to one of our recent acquisitions in Special Collections, an artist's book by the artist Tia Blassingame.
Right.
And I'm sure that that was done purposefully.
So we've got one of the oldest things in the exhibition next to one of the newest things.
Yes. And one of the reasons that it's paired like this, and it has to do with several themes that underlie the exhibition. One is the relationship of, and it comes back to that question, what are we looking for in Special Collections that speaks to Black visual culture? In some ways, it might just literally be the colophon, the type font, the graphic design that of a book that may or may not even be about African American content. So I wanted to register the significance of graphic design, but in this case, Tia Blassingame's book. And Richard, do you want to read the title over there?
Settled African American Sediment or Constant Middle Passage, Brooklyn.
So the book itself is Tia Blassingame's. It's a series of meditations that are elicited as poems, so like Phyllis Wheatley's book. And they're meditations on the Middle Passage, the slave trade, meditations that she had while walking the beach in Rhode Island, a very active state in the Middle Passage, the transatlantic slave trade. And it's interspersed with contemporary events, especially the recent killings, for example, say of Trayvon Martin. But she is meditating on an early slave ship that, in which many Africans died in transit. And the time period of the death of those individuals on that slave ship is the same time period in which Phyllis Wheatley was brought over as a slave to Boston. So there's a coincident history that's actually happening. It is an inventory of the things that were lost, in this case as cargo, the human cargo. And the date for that was between 1764 and 1765. And then if you look at Phyllis Wheatley, Wheatley was born in 1753 and brought to New England in 1761. So there's this relationship to what's happening in terms of the transport of the Black body. Right, that gets inscribed in various ways, very artistically in Tia Blassingame's book, but it too, a collection of poetry, a collection of images, that we wanted to make this connection between the old and the new that you see running throughout the exhibition.
Yes, the portrait of Phyllis Wheatley, the frontispiece of her book shows her, a very famous engraving, I believe it's an engraving with her, as a writer sitting with her hand up beside her face, pen in hand. So this representation of the body, of the black body, exists with a strong historical connection to the body represented in Tia Blassingame's book.
Now, I see. We're standing here around this book by two poets, and on the opposite wall are two large, almost poster arts that poetry is revolution. My country needs me. And if I were not here, I would have to be invented. I mean, this is another form of black visual culture.
So this work that you just referred to, My Country Needs Me by Rodney Ewing, is a lithograph. It's in the University Museum's collections. This work that you referred to is a poster that came from the library's special collections. So they're two very different artifacts, I would say. Rodney Ewing is referring, and in fact, he's given us the clue to the actual writer he's referring to as Hortense Spillers. But in fact, James Baldwin said something very similar, and other people had said something very similar. And it is with a very different kind of intonation than what you've just described in terms of your interaction, in the sense that the necessity of creating a scapegoat, a screen onto which to place some kind of difference or othering or blame. What we actually see is a montage of a African mask that was owned by Picasso and a portrait image of Louis Lennox, the boxer, if I actually have that correct.
Lennox Lewis,
yeah, sorry. That he's kind of montaged there, speaking to the insistence of the way in which, in this case, we could think about whiteness needing a black body, in this case, to denigrate or to blame. That is intricately tied in Hortense Spillers' history, her essay, to slavery, right? And the transatlantic slave trade. And it's been paired with a print by Camille Billops, also a lithograph. Both of these prints came from the Brandywine Workshop in Philadelphia, founded by Alan Edmonds. And in this case, what Camille Billops has given us is an image that speaks back to minstrelsy. So in this case, we have a young child that appears to be held in the arms of a young woman as though it's a mother and child. And behind it is sheet music from a song called Mammy's Little Coal Black Rose, but it is actually white figures in blackface. And it is the parallel to this thinking that Rodney Ewing is giving us, the necessity of creating some kind of other, some kind of difference, and even performing that difference, putting on that mask in a different way.
And this points to the importance of visual culture writ large, American visual culture, and the way that that culture has represented the black body in ways that informed American consciousnesses about black people, or misinformed, or did whatever it did. This, and thus the notion of I had to be invented as an image in order for people to learn what other people wanted to be learned about me. Black visual culture can be an intervention and a rewriting and a rescripting and an interruption of this massive American visual project that has been oftentimes racist at its core.
About to the left of that, Poetry is Revolution, is a portrait by Ming Smith of Amory Baraka. And in this case over here, we have two books by Amory Baraka, and a third one. And all of these get to that conundrum, or begin to etch out a history of what does black visual culture look like in special collections. In this case, we have a cover of a book that was published by Amory Baraka called It's Nation Time, and the cover itself has been designed by an artist. Or here we have two broadsides that are reproducing poems. This poem is by James Emanuel, and we also have a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks. But the design of the broadside are by two separate artists. And then the broadsides have been published by Dudley Randall in Detroit, who was a Black publisher. So in many instances, we see throughout this exhibition Black agency in self-publishing, self-design, and a kind of necessity of, if we go back to my country needs me, and if I were not here, I would have to be invented, speaking back to that by creating your own image, your own text, publishing them, designing them, maintaining a kind of control over it so that it isn't always spun through a kind of projection from whiteness.
One of the things I think is interesting that we haven't talked about yet are some of the images that sort of, if you will, portray life at different stages in Black American history.
Childhood is an important feature of this exhibition. We began, I believe, with the Faith Ringgold image of
Tanner
as a young boy, mm-hmm. seeing another artist who was African American. We happen to have a number of objects in the collection that speak to early childhood education, but also the representation of children. So we can go in this other gallery. In this small gallery, we have photographs, prints, paintings, as well as artist books that are heavily engaged with early images of children, as well as representations of education, with the idea in mind that education is highly informative for youth. We have a lithograph by Jacob Lawrence's wife, Gwendolyn Knight Lawrence, an image of a mother and a child, a lullaby that is a counterpoint to the Camille Billups image in the other room. But the other photographs are really asking us to think about the impact of life and education on children.
Tell us about these photographs. Let's see, this one is from about 1932 and the one below it from about 1984.
The top photograph shows the Tuskegee Institute String Quartet. It is from a series of photographs that we have by P.H. Polk. P.H. Polk was the lead photographer. He taught photography, and he also was the documentary photographer for Tuskegee Institute. A number of the photographs we have take up Tuskegee Institute, so we actually see the string quartet being photographed. And it's paired with a photograph by Jim Alexander called Bayou Blues. That is from around 1984. So here we have this very formal portrait. It's a studio portrait. There's a painted backdrop. You can see it just curling under the chair of the sitters. Down here, we have a much more informal portrait. They're sitting outside. The camera seems to focus on the postal box that we see. But many people will not know this because it's an early image, but this is Taj Mahal here, mm-hmm. in the center. And if you read the label over here, it tells you who the others are. Sylvester Oliver Jr., he's sitting over here, and he has a camera. He was an ethnomusicologist. So he's actually studying this very famous fiddler, Fontenot, who was a Creole, a Creole fiddler. And then Taj Mahal is just like hanging out, absorbing it, listening. So it's to get at different kinds of musical forms that have been really important for, in this case, African and African Creole traditions. Different ways to learn, right?
You could spend hours and hours in this exhibit and learn more and more as you take it in.
That's been my reaction at just about every University Museum's exhibition I've been to, that you can spend a long time, you know, learning a lot from the different pieces. And this exhibition, like all the University Museum exhibitions, is open, let me see if I can do this from memory now, is open Wednesdays through Sundays. Wednesday is the night you guys are open late, right? So that would be noon to 8 p.m. And on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, it's noon to 5. Thank you so much, Julie McGee, Associate Professor of Black American Studies and Art History, and Curtis Small, the Coordinator of Public Services, Library Special Collections. And thank you, Rachel and Rich, for helping me conduct this interview.
Thank you, Richard, for always having an interest in what we're doing at Mechanical Hall Gallery.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.